than small differences, such as 6 and 4. This is called the distance effect, and was first documented by two psychologists named Moyer and Landauer back in the 60s. The effect has since been confirmed many times in laboratory conditions, where people's responses are carefully measured. There is as much as a tenth of a second pause produced by closing in the two test numbers, compared to the speed with which subjects can distinguish them when they are far apart. What does this tell us? The standard interpretation for the distance effect is that in some sense we all have a mental number line. That's the line the teacher drew on the blackboard back in grade school, with 0 at one end, then 1, 2, 3, and so on. When asked to judge the difference between numbers, we may actually be judging magnitudes on this line. It's as if we had to view two physical lengths, like a ruler and a yardstick, and compare them. This, of course, is much easier to do when the sizes are very different. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Jordan Grafman at the National Institute of Mental Health. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41 in sports. Tony Sperano is the new head coach of the Miami Dolphins. The former assistant head coach of the Cowboys fills the vacancy created by last week's firing of Cam Cameron, who went 1-15 in his first year as an NFL head coach. Marion Jones appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show today and told the talk show host that seeing the pain her family and friends endured after she finally acknowledged using performance-enhancing drugs outweighed the impact of returning her Olympic medals. The disgraced American track and field star won 3 gold and 2 bronze medals at the 2000 Sydney Games. The top two teams in the AP men's college basketball rankings are preparing for action tonight. Number 1 North Carolina is at Georgia Tech, while second-ranked Memphis plays at Rice. The Illini men still haven't managed a win in Big Ten play, but they're hoping that will change when they play Michigan at Assembly Hall tonight. Illinois has lost 5 in a row, including its last 3 home games. The Wolverines, meanwhile, ended their own 5-game losing streak Saturday with a 78-68 win at Northwestern. The Chicago Bulls are in Florida again tonight to take on a Miami Heat team that's lost 10 games in a row. That is hoping the return of Shaquille O'Neal can help break that streak. Chicago has struggled to a 14-22 record, but Miami is worse. Its record, 18-28. And the Chicago Blackhawks and the St. Louis Blues face off at the United Center tonight. That's a look at sports. It's 2:43.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Mahomet, Tuscola, and Danville, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
The increase in U.S. troops in Iraq is widely credited with reducing violence in Baghdad and other parts of the country. Another result of last year's surge? There are now nearly twice as many suspected Iraqi insurgents in U.S. custody, nearly 24,000 in all. The U.S. military is trying to figure out how to hold detainees without allowing detention camps to become recruiting centers for radical militant groups. NPR's Corey Flintoff visited the biggest U.S. detention center and filed this report.
The crowd gathers just after dusk outside a freshly tiled and painted building with a ceremonial red ribbon stretched across its entrance. Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Williams steps up to the microphone.
Today we open the Dar Hikma Book of Freedom School, I guess I can call it part 2. The buildings you see will support higher education for our detainee population.
Dar al-Hikma is the Arabic name for the new school. It means House of Wisdom, and the U.S. military hopes it will be a transformational place for the nearly 20,000 Iraqis housed at this sprawling detention camp in the desert of far southern Iraq. Brigadier General Michael Nevin believes that basic education is one of the keys to returning former militants to Iraqi society. The U.S. detention system offers 1st through 5th grade schooling for some nearly illiterate detainees, as well as health care, family visitations, and a military system for reviewing their cases. Nevin admits that it hasn't been easy to convince his fellow commanders that this is an important part of fighting the war.
This is seen as a byproduct of war fighting, but you've got to look at it in a counterinsurgency terms. All of the population engagements you do are part of the counterinsurgency effort, and this is a significant population engagement. The spheres of influence in the Iraqi society, each detainee represents 100 family members, tribal members, relatives, friends that care about him. With the population that we have, we're affecting the perceptions of 2.5 million Iraqis.
Until the surge began last spring, Camp Buka had a much smaller population, but it was a chaotic and dangerous place. Radical inmates fought their guards with stones, burned down their barracks, and imposed their own rules on the other detainees. Major General Doug Stone, the commander of U.S. detention operations in Iraq, says that worst of all, hardened militants were able to use the camps to recruit young men. He says that some young detainees were not extremists, but were bribed or intimidated into taking part. Some may have been innocent.
In fact, there are mistakes made. Very significant guys get away and are unknown, and guys that are oftentimes very minimally involved are wrapped up.
Stone says that much of the anger in the camp stemmed from the fact that the detainees have not been convicted of anything and have no fixed sentences, so there's a sense of isolation and hopelessness. One way of combating that is to bring each detainee before a military review board that can examine his case and recommend that he be released. A young man stands before a tribunal composed of two officers and a senior enlisted man. He fidgets, and his yellow prison jumpsuit and windbreaker hang loosely from skinny shoulders. This is the review board. Frank Hutchison is a Navy lieutenant commander and a lawyer.
The detainee walks into the room and he's read his rights, an approved set of rights that is given to the detainee. At that point, the detainee is swore in. He swears on the Quran, if he's Muslim, and not all of them are. And then at that point, the detainee has read what he's been alleged to have done to get him here. And then the board is sort of a give and take.
Hutchison says the sessions last anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour, and the three-person boards have to process a lot of them to meet their goal of reviewing every inmate every 6 months.
In a typical day, we do anywhere between 160 to 200 people. In fact, as many as 240 there for a while.
At the end of the hearing, the detainee is told that he'll receive a letter in 45 days telling him whether he'll be released or extended for another 6 months. If the board feels that he's made progress in detention, he may be recommended to take part in educational, vocational, and religious programs. It's not due process as Americans know it, but Colonel James Brown, the commander of Camp Buka, says it breaks the cycle of hopelessness that helps turn people who were minor fighters into full-blown radicals.
It has an enduring effect because the majority of the guys that we recommend, they stay. The reason we're recommending they stay is because the clear preponderance of evidence is that they were engaged in anti-coalition combat, that since they were doing that, the likelihood is very high that they will continue to do that, and they understand that. But they respect being a part of the process.
For those who don't get to go home, there's the school and a religious program run by an imam who leads discussions of the Quran and tries to refute the teachings of religious radicals known as Takfiris. Because they're zealous and well-organized, they can recruit or intimidate more moderate inmates in their compounds, ruling them like gang leaders in American prisons. The American strategy at Camp Buka is to identify the radicals and move them into separate compounds at one end of the camp. Colonel Brown.
These are the Takfiri and Al-Qaeda compounds. These guys came from hardened groups, extremists, that were fighting us, that they believe is that you kill anybody who doesn't agree with your extremely rigid view of Islam, especially other Islamic people.
Brown says that even the most extreme inmates still have their status reviewed every 6 months and that they have access to family visits and educational programs, although most refuse to take part. Since they've been segregated and since the review process began last August, the American commanders say that even the radical compounds have been quiet. The biggest problem with them is that the inmates are constantly working to escape, digging tunnels and tearing up their mattresses to make clothes that will cover their canary yellow prison uniforms once they're outside. Major General Doug Stone, the detention operations commander, says that's something that keeps him awake nights.
The thing that I do think about all the time is the guys that are really, really smart. And have they figured out how to jiu-jitsu me and our fighters? I mean, have they already infiltrated something, or have they already engaged in understanding our behavior and what we want to do so well that they've adapted to us and I don't see it?
One weakness of Stone's strategy is simply that the educational and religious programs are still too new and too small to reach more than a few of the nearly 20,000 detainees at Camp Buka. His commanders are working to create more space for programs, but they say they need more guards to supervise the detainees and move them from place to place inside the camp to be effective in what Stone calls the battlefield of the mind. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Baghdad.
The business community won a major victory in the Supreme Court yesterday. It's a ruling that is expected to put an end to many fraud cases brought by investors. By a 5-3 vote, the justices blocked almost all efforts to recover losses from those who play a secondary role in schemes to defraud stockholders. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg explains.
The ramifications of yesterday's ruling are in the billions and involve suits like the one brought by Enron investors against banks that are accused of helping Enron conceal its perilous financial condition. The actual case decided by the court involves a cable company named Charter Communications. The SEC said Charter engaged in sham transactions with two of its cable box suppliers. Using backdated documents, the suppliers helped Charter conceal a $20 million cash shortfall on its balance sheet. When Charter's day of reckoning finally came, the losing investors sued not just Charter, but the cable box suppliers to recover damages. The investors claimed that the suppliers, as knowing enablers, were liable too. To the business community, this theory of so-called scheme liability was terrifying. John Engler is president of the National Association of Manufacturers.
If you start to bootstrap liability that way, I mean, the fear was, where does this end?
The Bush administration backed the business community in a do-or-die test case before the Supreme Court, while the Securities and Exchange Commission, 32 states and investors, including pension funds, backed those claiming secondary participants in a fraud scheme are liable. The Supreme Court sided with the business community. Writing for the five-justice majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said that Congress did not authorize such investor lawsuits against secondary players in a securities fraud case unless it could be shown that the secondary players themselves filed misleading financial reports or made erroneous public statements on which investors relied. In this case, said Justice Kennedy, since no member of the public knew about the cable box suppliers' deceptive acts, the investors didn't rely on them for information, and the suppliers aren't liable. The SEC, he said, can punish the suppliers, but investors can't sue to recover damages. Christopher Patti represents the University of California, one of the institutional investors suing secondary players in the Enron case.
This does shut the door pretty firmly on most of these claims, but perhaps not all of them.
Patti contends that the Enron suits may survive because they are mainly against investment banks, which he says were directly counseling investors that Enron was a good stock, while at the same time designing schemes to cover up the company's insolvency. Most observers, even ones sympathetic to the investors, think that yesterday's Supreme Court ruling will doom even the Enron suit. Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan, a Democrat, joined with the Republican Texas Attorney General in the Supreme Court on behalf of investors. He compares yesterday's decision to a nonsensical rule on bank robbery.
You could plan the bank robbery and drive the getaway car, but if you don't go in and hold a gun to the teller, then you're not liable in a civil fraud suit. That doesn't make any sense.
Dan says the only way to hold secondary actors in security fraud accountable to investors now is to amend the federal securities law to expressly allow such suits. The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, says he won't waste time on such an effort as long as George Bush is president, because Mr. Bush would almost certainly veto the bill. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Before you vote in the February 5th Illinois primary, find out where the candidates stand on the issues Saturday evenings at 6, AM 580 will rebroadcast WILL-TV's specials For the People, Primary Focus. John Paul moderates these discussions, co-sponsored by the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. That's For the People, Primary Focus, Thursday nights at 7:30 on WILL-TV and Saturday evenings at 6 here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Coming up at 3, it's The World from PRI. On the program today, Alex Kurzum was a small child in 1941. Nazis executed his Jewish mother. He would have been shot, but he survived the war as a kind of mascot for a Nazi battalion. His story in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon at 3, and you can hear the program as well in the evenings, Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. here on WILL Urbana.
Earth and Sky.
The discovery that chimpanzees use tools to dig up edible tubers might help us understand our human origins better.
Anthropologist Jim Moore of the University of California, San Diego, studies chimps in the Ugala region of Tanzania. A 2007 study that he helped guide provides the first evidence that chimps use tools to forage for tubers.
A lot of models of human evolution have emphasized the importance of some kind of technology that allows us to do things that other animals, other primates anyway, haven't been able to do. And one of those, and probably a central one, is the use of sticks to dig up roots and tubers.
Tubers such as sweet potatoes and cassava were important foods for early hominids. Moore told Earth and Sky that the Ugala chimps forage for tubers in much the same way as our human ancestors might have.
Finding chimpanzees doing a very primitive, a very simplified version of this presents us with a sort of a way of understanding how that behavior that's so important to modern human foragers could have got started.
It's a finding that Moore said complicates the line between human and non-human, but that might help us understand our own origins.
It gives us a way of studying the behavioral side of the origin of something that was critical in allowing us to expand around the world and allowing us to become who we are.
We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2008 series presents Information Technology and the Dream of Democratic Renewal by Langdon Winner on Wednesday, January 23rd at 4 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum. More information is available online at www.cas.uiuc.edu.
A winter storm watch is in effect for Joe Davis County in extreme northwestern Illinois from this evening through tomorrow afternoon. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Tonight, in northwestern Illinois, cloudy with snow. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with patches of light rain and light snow. Lows ranging from around 20 in far northwestern Illinois to 32 in the far south. Tomorrow, in the north and in central sections, cloudy with periods of snow. In the south, cloudy with some rain and snow. Highs ranging from 24 in far northwestern Illinois to around 40 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with some sprinkles and flurries possible during the evening, then occasional light snow after midnight. The low tonight, 25. The wind from the southeast to south at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with periods of light snow. An accumulation of an inch or two is possible. The high, 33. The wind tomorrow from the south to southwest at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with some flurries during the evening hours. The low, 18. The outlook for Friday, mostly cloudy with a chance of light snow late in the day, the high 27. Friday night, cloudy and turning colder with periods of light snow, the low 5. Saturday, mostly cloudy and cold, the high around 10. At 1 minute before 3 o'clock, it's 37 degrees in Urbana. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Stay with us for The World. That's coming up next.